Welcome. Welcome to Recipe for Peace Now. I'm your host, Sue Beller, and this is the show where we find practical, real-life solutions to difficulties bringing people together for a common goal, a common good. We will discuss listener emails, answer common questions, and at the end of the show, we will have, well, we'll have two delicious potluck recipes made for sharing with your new community of, well, if not exactly friends, at least willing participants. If you would like to send in a question or a favorite recipe, please email us at recipeforpeacenow@gmail.com or visit our website, www.recipeforpeacenow.com. If you would like to hear prior shows, the last five are actually archived on the website, recipeforpeacenow.com. All of the shows, including the most recent five, are archived at the radio station at blogtalkradio.com/recipeforpeacenow. Thanks. Now let's get started. You know, this time we said that the topic was going to be education. And it gets announced a couple of days in advance, and we got quite a bit of discussion already, and thank you very much for all of your emails. And people thought that education meant educational credentials, being an expert, being an attorney, being a doctor, whatever it needs to be. And that wasn't exactly what we had in mind, but that's great, because this show is, of course, organic, as we all know. And I see there's lots of you here already. Thank you for your participation. Yes, it's organic, and it goes according to whatever you ask, and wherever the discussion goes, that's where the show gets taken. So let's talk about educational credentials first, although really when we put out the show topic, we kind of thought of it as continuing education, the research that we do as we go along in order to, well, to find out what's the latest news, what's been done before on the specific topics that we're going to be discussing, right? Right. Okay, so let's talk about educational credentials, because there's quite a bit of interest in it. And thank you very much for all of your participation. And so I think that the first question, we're going to do educational credentials first. Do they make a difference? When you're hosting, when you're participating, does anybody's educational credentials, actual piece of paper, make a difference when we are doing a mediation, a workshop, a seminar, someone is the host? What does it make a difference? And we've got thank you for all of your participation. You know, we've got quite a few yeses. We've got quite a few votes on that side. And, for example, Kali says that, yes, the educational credentials do make a difference because they add authority to your opinions if the leader is an attorney or a specific expert on the subject. That's authority to the opinion of the person who has the credential. People listen to you better. I suppose that's true. We're getting a lot of agreement with that. People are saying, especially if the host is an attorney. Thank you. People say, what do you think? Well, in all truth and honesty, I'm a biased observer, of course, because I'm an attorney. But I think the intelligence of the person is rather more important than the piece of paper, because I am naming no names, but I know some attorneys and other people who have an educational credential who are not the most practical, the most useful, the most let's try to get this done goal-oriented people in the entire universe. Yes, I'm getting a lot of agreement. Oh, people are giving examples. Oh, my. But Malik and others are saying that educational credentials will make others consider your opinions more seriously. Yeah. We had authority to your opinions and more seriously. Well, it does kind of make you an expert. And at least in the beginning, until someone proves themselves unworthy, I think perhaps an educational credential is useful. Mm-hmm. It starts the talk. It starts the ball rolling. Now, we have quite a few people. Now, we've got a lot of people that are agreeing about educational credentials, at least at the beginning, give you a certain amount of authority. And people will listen to your opinion first and then think about it. Mm-hmm. And I got a lot of agreement with the fact that I'm not certain that it makes you that intelligent. And we've got quite a few people voting no, that educational credentials are not an asset when you're leading, when you're participating in, well, whatever we're doing, a community gathering, a mediation, an arbitration, a workshop, a seminar, a class. For example, Terry says that credentials make you certain of your opinions and you refuse to look further. Can we say that sometimes you might get a little arrogant if you've got kind of fancy educational credentials? Yes, I see the word arrogance being used here. Like intransigence, other words that really cover this. And Lord Terry says that credentials make you certain of your opinion and you refuse to look further. Makes you stubborn, right? Sometimes. It depends on the person, doesn't it? Right? And in prior shows, we've talked about bias, and we've talked about compromise, and we've talked about other things that lead to, well, you can't be stubborn about your opinion. And you have to, yes, self-fulfilling prophecy. People are going, that's a self-fulfilling prophecy, yes. But you have to, you could start with an opinion, of course, but perhaps being the most educated person in the room makes you kind of stubborn on your opinion, huh? Getting a lot of agreement on that. Thank you for all of your participation. It's very nice. I love seeing all of you. So Terry says credentials make you certain of your opinions and you refuse to look further. That can happen, right? Mm-hmm. You know, Carol is voting no, and other people are voting no, too, with this general idea that having an actual fancy credential will make people blindly follow the person with credentials and refuse to consider alternatives. Yeah, people get kind of swayed. That goes to the authority that we talked about and to the having your opinion taken a little more seriously. But you don't want people to have someone who's really leading the pack and everybody's just following. Because, well, it's easier, right? Yeah, people are saying, well, it's easy. It's easy to get in with the group and just see one path because, of course, that makes it seem more simple, right? And, yes, this is true, and people are saying it also abbreviates the process. It doesn't take as long if you've got somebody who says, this is what we're going to do, and this is how we're going to do it because I know these things. I am an expert. I have the credentials. Now, this is a very good point that's being made. That we cannot be biased, that they're wrong. Sometimes they're right. You know, sometimes I'm right. No, sometimes that is what should be done. And it's good to have someone with focus and goal orientation, right, to help us, to lead us. We've talked in prior shows about leadership and what it means to be a leader and how important that is. How important it is to listen, but to have confidence to go forward. Yes, and the main point is, of course, in that is listen. And you can't be too stubborn in your opinion, but it might be the right one after due consideration by the group, by everyone. You might think about it and go, you know what? That's a really good idea. That's the way. That's what we're going to try. Yes, let's all get behind that, mark the path, and go forward. You know, we're practical people at Recipe for Peace now, and we have very few rules except the one that says you consider everyone's opinion, you take the reasonable, logical next step as you go through the process. And, you know, reasonable, logical thing to do can only be judged at that time. Hindsight is always 20/20, but you need to be able to judge it and to go forward, right? Because otherwise you get kind of bogged down and the process doesn't go anywhere. Yeah, people are saying the word stagnate, and that's true. You get to a point where it goes, oh, my God, this is never getting anywhere, and everybody wanders off. That's a bad thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you don't want to blindly follow someone, but you should consider the alternatives. And if they've got credentials and they know what they're doing, well, they might have a good idea. Can't be biased. That's a very good point. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you for all of your participation. Wonderful to see you. You know, Andrew and others are making a very good point also that experience credentials are more important than educational credentials. Experience credentials are more important than educational credentials. You know, that's a very good point. And you know what? I'm getting a lot of people asking the same question. And, you know, and we just discussed that this show is kind of organic. We go wherever the questions take us. And a lot of people are asking, people understand what an educational credential is, right? It means you've gone through a lot of schooling and you have received a degree, an expert certification, a degree in, well, whatever it is that people find to be compelling for the issues at hand. A lot of times, people who do mediation happen to be attorneys because we have a lot of training in getting the various sides to talk to each other, right? Yes, and most of you know that I happen to be one. Yes, and you get a lot of training and a lot of coaching training, I would call it. And, you know, they talk about how to handle juries and things like that. And it leads to the ability to get the sides to come together to make a settlement. And that's very important. And it's a good skill. And you don't need to be an attorney. People go, you don't need to be an attorney to do that. No. And there's all kinds of different kinds of classes that you can take to help you along with learning how to do that. And in all truth and honesty, Recipe for Peace Now teaches lots of classes, right? And there's a book if you look at the website, and it is a learned skill. But that might also be an experience credential, right? So our next question, the question that's being asked by lots of people, is what are experience credentials? What does that mean? When you say, well, I don't have an educational credential, which people understand what that means, I have an experience credential. Credential, follow me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Desjardins and other people are doing a definition that I would really think would be quite good, quite what I think of when I say experience credential, and you might disagree. And thank you for all of your participation. Desjardins says that it's experience credential was when you have successfully resolved a similar situation. Yeah, a lot of people are saying that. Correct. When you have successfully resolved a similar situation. Yeah, you can say, look, I was involved with these issues, this group, this type of, well, fill in the blank, and we successfully resolved it. I know what we did then, and I think that what we did then is applicable to what needs to be done now. What an idea. Yeah. I think that we can do that. That we can apply the same ideas, the same basic template, so to speak. Yes. People use the word template. Yeah. It's a good point. Although you don't want to get into the idea that there is an actual single way, because every situation differs slightly, right? Yeah. So that's the sticky point. Yeah. But you successfully resolved a similar situation. That's certainly an experience credential. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Liana and others are saying that it means that you have successfully mediated with similar types of groups. See, it's unusual, kind of, to find someone who has done really a very similar situation. Because hopefully, if the situation was successfully resolved, it doesn't have to be done again. Yeah, okay. Or, well, it's sometimes, yeah, people are saying different. Sometimes you do because, you know, in the United States, and I know this is a global show, and so that may not be applicable, but it's probably applicable, hello, applicable to other places in the world, too, where you've got provinces and districts and stuff that are kind of separate but together. In the United States, each state has their own rules and regulations. They are overridden by the federal law, which is the overreaching law that governs the entire United States. But the states themselves have different rules, have different state laws. They actually have different taxing systems, in all truth and honesty, which is kind of strange. But it's true. And I know that it's true in a lot of countries, that your province, something that we call a state, is called something else, a district, a province, whatever. But you've got some local rules, right? And then cities have regulations also. But mainly it's state regulations that are kind of overreaching on the individuals. And therefore, what I'm telling you is that you could have successfully resolved the similar situation in a different state, and a different city, and a different school district. Yes, people are going school district. Yeah, any kind of district and like that. And thank you for all of your participation. But it's possible to have actually done it someplace else. And now this state, this group, would like to have it done wherever they're living. So, yeah, so it's possible to have the exact, well, exact being a bad word, but a very, very similar situation. But if not, Leanna and others are pointing out that you could have successfully mediated with a similar type of group or with these groups, these people, in a different set of issues. But you know the people. You know the group. You know the organization. That's an experience credential. I have already a relationship with these people, with this organization, with this group, and maybe even both sides or whatever side, how many sides you've got. You may have sides, but we've dealt with each other and we understand each other, and I'm not starting from the beginning. We already have a relationship. Mm-hmm. You've mediated successfully. Good point, Leanna and others. Thank you. And you know, and this is interesting too. A lot of people, like Janik and other people, are saying that you're an expert, you have an experience credential because you're an expert due to your experience in the field. Yeah, that's a really good point, because depending on the issues, right, and we have talked about using experts in the past. And by the way, if you wanted to hear prior shows, they've all got, you know, headings and descriptions and like that. The most recent five, including this one, just pretty much as soon as we get off the air, are archived on the website, recipeforpeacenow.com. All of the shows, including the most recent five, are archived at the radio station at blogtalkradio.com/recipeforpeacenow. Yeah. So we've talked about experts, but yeah, you could be an expert because of your experience in the field, and that would certainly give you an experience credential, wouldn't it? I have worked in this area. I have seen it. I have done it. I know the practicalities of what you're talking about. I know what can be done and what can't be done within certain parameters that that the group will discuss, because maybe what the expert thinks can't be done might be possible with some revision. But you know what I mean. It's somebody who has been out there and has a real sense of the practical. And I do love a real sense of the practical, because that's how to really achieve a workable solution. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's what we want. We're not a theoretical group here. We want to find out what to do and how to do it, and how to do it so that it'll work. And we don't have to have this whole discussion again. We've got it. It's going. We're good. Yeah. So it's all good. Yeah. Okay. So that would be an experience credential also. And now, okay, now let's get on to the topic that I thought we were going to discuss. It's kind of like, oh, hello. And that was kind of continuing education, concerning the specific topics, the specific issues that are in front of you. Mm-hmm. Really, how should we approach the research and the learning for the issues at hand? Mm-hmm. Because we need to form a goal, right? Yeah. In fact, thank you. Frank and others are saying that you need to be goal-oriented. Research and learning to achieve specific results. Right. Because people in the group, I, for example, as the host, could have a lot of general knowledge, a good idea of what works and what doesn't work, like with laws or regulations or something. But we have a specific task in front of us, right? A specific issue. Something that we want to get done. And that's the goal-oriented education. We want to see what it is that needs to be done. And we need to research that topic. We need to get some learning. We need to get some education on that. Mm-hmm. So how should we go about this? And yes, goal-oriented, we got a lot of agreement on goal-oriented. And Meyer and others are making a good point. Sometimes we call them subcommittees on this show. But you need to work in teams to prevent individual bias. Mm-hmm. Work in teams to prevent individual bias. Mm-hmm. You might call your team a subcommittee, depending on what kind of a group it is and how you know, the designation team, subcommittee, like they all have kind of preconceived notions to them, so you have to be a little bit careful. But yeah, Meyer and others are right. We're getting a lot of agreement. Thank you for your participation, that you need to work in teams to prevent individual bias. Right. And Anne and others are also mentioning that in order to go forward with education on the specific topics, on research, on thinking, on looking up what it is that other people have done, really. Isn't that what research is? What other people have done that has succeeded? And, yes, good point. A lot of people are saying that the more interesting one is not only what has been done that succeeded, but what has been attempted that failed. That's really interesting, too, isn't it? Because then you go, well, why didn't that work? Because it seemed reasonable and doable and workable and goal-oriented and the right path when the people started out, when that group started it, when they took it on as a project, right? It seemed good. Why not? What happened? See, that's really interesting to report back to the group because, you know, I suppose it's an American idiom. And, of course, this I happen to be an American, but this is a global show. But you know the expression, you don't need to reinvent the wheel each time? It means that, a lot of people are using it, that you don't need to reinvent the wheel each time. And it means you don't have to start blind from the beginning. You can look at what other people have done, and you could go, oh, that's a good idea. We'll bring it to the group. Yeah. And we'll talk about it. Never thought of that. Wow. Or you can go, wow, that seemed like a good idea. How come it didn't work that time? And how can we? Right. How can we modify it? Yes. And, you know, people are agreeing that sometimes the things that don't work are just as interesting, education-wise, as the things that did work, that do work. Because you can go, how can we modify this? How can we use it in our situation and be successful? What an idea, huh? Mm-hmm. So work in teams to prevent individual bias is a really good idea. You know, it depends how big the group is, right? Because if you have a lot of issues, then you divide them up for the research because there's a lot of research, right? Or everybody could bring in some research if it's a small group. They could research the issues and research what's been done, and we could discuss it and their opinions and what their organization, for example, thinks and their practical experience. You see, it Yeah, I know. I'm going to say it depends. People are going, you're saying it depends again. Yes, I know that I say that a lot, but it does. It depends on the complexity of the issues. It depends really on how many issues you're really faced with. Sometimes you know what you want. It's a question of how to get it, and there aren't a whole lot of ways. Do you understand what I mean? It's not so complex. Sometimes it's very complex, and it depends how many people are in the group and how many teams you need. Yeah. So you work in teams. And a lot of times, teams don't research, everybody doesn't research different things. It's just a way to get different opinions, different ideas, right? And Anne says that, and a lot of people are saying, that the main thing is to encourage new ideas. Pardon me, to encourage new ideas. Because we all come, right, with some preconceived notions, some opinions about the topic, or we wouldn't be there. We wouldn't be there if we didn't have an interest, right? Right. And because we have an interest, we've got some, yeah, we've got some preconceived notions about it and what needs to be done and what should be done. We have to have some continuing education to see how that has gone in the past, right? Yeah. A lot of people are using the phrase, which I think is probably another American idiom, to think outside the box is important. To try to get away from your preconceived notions and what you thought when you came in, and to be open to new ideas, right? That's what the continuing education is for. That's what the research is for. That's why we don't, you know, in today's day and age, with the internet, it is so easy to get information that sometimes you get overwhelmed. Ah, this is a very good point. Kamini and others are saying that yes, and because of that, and because there's so much, how shall I put this delicately? Well, kind of strange stuff out there. And you have to consider it, right? You have to consider the source. And sometimes stuff just lies and is wrong because it's got a bias. Whoever wrote it, whoever put it in has a bias. And Kamini and others are saying that the main thing that you have to do when you're doing research, when you're doing learning as a group, education as a group, because that's what we're doing. We're educating ourselves on these specific topics, on what's been done, what needs to be done, what has failed, what's out there. We're educating. But you need to create high standards and expectations of careful research, presenting all sides. Good point, Kamini and others. Yes, because you got to weed out the junk. And even if you present the junk, you got to present it as, well, this is an opinion. You have to create high standards and expectations of careful research, presenting all sides. High standards and high expectations, yes. You will not take up our time, please, with some really out there idea that has no basis, even though you actually saw it on your computer screen. Now, this is an interesting point, and of course, you know, as we've talked, we just said this, but the show is kind of organic, and I have a question that's being asked by lots of people, and this show, right, is pragmatic. We're real practical, and what people are asking is, that's nice about the expectations and the standards and the research and the teams and the lack of bias, but as a practical question, how do you manage to do that? How do you keep control of the research, of the education, of the learning, not to bias it, but just to make sure that it's quality, that it's got high standards and expectations, as Kamini and others have said, that it's something that's useful and hasn't just gone off on some sort of a weird tangent and will derail the process because we've lost focus. Remember, we need to focus and we need to focus towards our goal and to get to where we need to be to get a successful result. So it's a practical question. How do you do this? How do you make the education, make the research, make the learning useful? Mm-hmm. And, of course, that's one of the things that we do as leader, as host, right? And Stephen and others are saying that the team and subcommittee makeup should be with people of varying abilities so that they have all perspectives. It's an interesting point, and that is something that I always try to do. If you make teams or subcommittees or whatever you want to call them, smaller groups that go off and research a specific subject, it's important, as Stephen says, that they have varying abilities. Yes, and thank you for all of your participation. I'm getting a lot of agreement on that. The reason being that if everybody is really like-minded, you're going to get a skewed research result because they're all going to confirm, you know, there's confirmation bias, right? That people confirm what it is that they thought to begin with. They like the stuff that agrees with them. And if everybody is of like mind, it won't be much of a presentation to the group because everybody will have confirmed their like mind with the research and ignored the rest. So, yeah, the group should make up should be with people of varying abilities so that you get all perspectives. Good point, Stephen and others. Thank you very much for all of your participation. You know, and Diane and others are saying that not only should there be varying degrees of ability and expertise and opinion, but you need to explore new directions when it's dictated by the research. Sometimes you find out something new. In fact, oftentimes you do. And that's why it's called education and not just confirmation. You find out something new, a new idea. And it's something that you need to look into to find out if that's a valid point, if that's a good idea. Yes, thank you. People are going to find out if it's a good idea or it's just kind of a theory and it's bogus and it doesn't work. Yeah, so you need to explore in new directions. And, of course, the group needs to be able to do that. You know, and a lot of people are saying this, and Nicholas and others are saying that, yes, that's really good to go into new directions, but you have to be careful to stay focused on the goal so that you don't get sidetracked with interesting trivia. Yeah, we've all done that, right? You sit down at the computer and you have a task that you need to do, and then you look at the front page there where there's all kinds of news and stuff, and you go, oh, my, that's weird. And you get kind of sidetracked for 20 minutes going, oh, didn't know that the cows had three heads. Yes, you get kind of sidetracked. And so it's a good point that you need to explore new directions, but as Nicholas says, you need to be careful to stay focused on your goal so that you don't get sidetracked with interesting trivia. Yeah, and that's why you talk amongst yourselves, because that's part of the discussion as to whether or not this goes to our goal, whether or not this is useful, or it's interesting, but doesn't apply here, or is too far down the road for us to use at the moment. You see? Interesting trivia. You know, Sylvia and others are making an interesting point that as a practical question on how to get good research and education and to continue on and to have teams and like that, it's very important to have a positive attitude. A lot of people are mentioning that. That the team members and like that, you have to have a positive attitude and you need to expect to succeed or else you're going to get discouraged. Important to have a positive attitude. Good point. And you know, as a very practical thought, and we touched on this with our high standards and expectations, as a very practical thought, and I do this all the time because it's very important, James and others are saying that you need to ask the members who have done the research, if it's everybody, that's great. If it's teams, whatever. But anybody who brings in something from the outside world that's opinions, that's research, that's a way of doing something, you need to ask them, and across the board, so that nobody's insulted, they need to show the basis for their research and conclusions. And not just come with a conclusion, not just come with an opinion. But we need to see it. And we need to know where on earth it came from. Because that's important. Because especially on the internet, research has a bias. And you have to, you might think it's very interesting and might be terribly useful. You might agree. But you should know the side from which it came. You should know, understand what it is that you're looking at, whether it is facts, how the facts and statistics were done. You see, this all makes a difference. You need the basis before you can really make a discerning choice. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Olivia and others are saying that it's really important to show the research so that everyone can make their own conclusions and then decide on the next step as a group. Yeah. You'd like to see how you came to that conclusion, how you came to that frame of mind, that opinion. Let's think about it, and let's think about drawing our conclusions from what we have in front of us, and how we should go forward as a group. Mm-hmm. Yeah, people are saying that it's terribly important to be able to weed out what is true and what is false. Yes, we've talked about truth in prior shows too. You know, we should probably do another one. But truth is subject to interpretation. I like to think of it more as the sense of what is, yes, thank you. A lot of people are doing this. A lot of people are saying the question is more like what is fact and what is opinion. People are going, what is fact and what is fiction? But we'll assume that we've weeded out things that are actually fiction. But what's the facts? What's the actual numbers? I like to get to the bottom of how opinions and conclusions are formed. Because a lot of what we see is really somebody's conclusion, right, when we do research. I like to see how they made it, how that was determined. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and Doreen says, then you discuss the conclusions, write them down on a public board or someplace like on an email or something, and then decide which is a logical next step. Yeah. In order to decide logic, you have to decide the basis for where the education came from. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And all of this is really discussion among the group, right? And it is bringing research and education and information to the group so we can all form a reasoned course of action and a workable solution to whatever it is that we're doing. And that's one of the reasons, and this concept of group in a reasonable, practical, goal-oriented fashion is really what Recipe for Peace Now does, right? And one of the ways, of course, that we do it, and yes, people are going, oh, we get into the recipes. Yes, we are. One of the ways that we do it is that we create a convivial atmosphere because we want to be able to talk freely, to give our opinions, to form the path, to form the logical next step. And in order to create the convivial atmosphere, we usually have food. We usually have, well, I call it a potluck, but it doesn't have to be. But a way to break bread together, a way to create an atmosphere where all opinions are welcomed and considered. And if someone's opinion is not the final thought, they're not insulted. They don't huff off. They don't feel that their opinion has not been valued. See, it's a question of valuing your fellow participant. And that's very important because you want to be valued. Your opinions want to be heard. They want to be considered, and they want to be knitted into the fabric of the whole for what our goal is and what we're going to do. And everybody's opinion and everybody's thought counts, right? And then we make the logical choices and we go forward. And the convivial atmosphere helps that. I always say, and I thank you for all of your participation. A lot of you have come back, so you know that I say this. But I always say that the food is a tool to get to a faster, more reasoned, more workable solution. Because we have dealt with our fellow human in a more convivial manner, right? Now, and I'm going to say the same thing that I say every show, and you can look back at the shows and find that out. The last five are archived on the website, recipeforpeacenow.com. All of the shows are archived at the radio station, blogtalkradio.com/recipeforpeacenow. But I always say this because it's so important. If you're going to have food, and you are, because we're going to make a convivial atmosphere, you need to communicate to all participants, email, phone, however it is you've been communicating, if anyone has an allergic reaction to food, an allergy, a food prohibition, or a religious prohibition. You don't want people to have a bad time. The whole idea is to have a convivial time, to get together, to be able to work together on a people-to-people basis, which is really what we do. And so you're going to ask about allergies, food sensitivities, or food restrictions, and religious restrictions. Then, and I think this is terribly important, you're going to ask everyone when they bring something to label the food, not what it's called, meatloaf. No, what's actually in it, so that people can make a decision, a reasoned decision, right, on whether or not they can eat it. Yeah, very important. And also, I truly think that, especially since I hate running out of food, I think that the host should have some extra food because it's not a party if there's not enough to go around. And I think there should be at least one safe recipe. Now, what on earth is a safe recipe? A safe recipe is one that does not have too terrible many ingredients. The ingredients are fairly obvious, and they would be something that participants in your area, and this is a global show, so my participants, what they would commonly eat is different than what your participants would commonly eat. And I get a lot of questions, and the answer is yes, substitute whatever you like. These recipes are not copyrighted. No, these are just general ideas, and you can put in more things or take out things, however your taste runs. But a safe recipe has ingredients that after we take the survey about the people and allergy prohibitions, either food prohibitions or religious prohibitions, after we take that survey, we're fairly certain that our people can eat it, and we still label it because we need to. So here, this is the safe recipe for today, and it's a butternut squash risotto. I'm extremely fond of butternut squash. I just think it's delicious because it's kind of sweet. And this risotto is nice because it's easily dished out. I don't know. People are asking already if it's a main dish. If you have enough on the counter, nothing is a main dish. It's to take some. People can take as much as they want. I always make lots. So this is not. And of course, that I give kind of a six-person type recipe or something, but you double it, triple it, whatever it is. So that not everybody will take lots and not everybody will take some because there's other stuff on the counter. But anyway, so this is our safe recipe, the butternut squash risotto. We're going to have 2 tablespoons of olive oil, an onion, finely chopped, 1.5 pounds of butternut squash. Yes, it needs to be peeled and seeded and chopped and like that. Those of you who have been here before, and thank you for all of your participation, know that in all truth and honesty, it is easily available to me to get frozen butternut squash that has already been cubed, peeled, seated, cleaned, it's ready to go. And that's what I'm going to use because it's cheaper, it's easier, and there it is, it's faster. So if you don't have that, if you use fresh, yours will be better than mine. But I'm going to use the frozen, about a pound and a half of it. And, of course, if you're going to use frozen, you must thaw it and drain it, pat it dry. Otherwise, you'll get too much water in the thing. About a cup and a half of risotto, which is really kind of fancy rice. If you don't have risotto, use rice. Brown rice is actually quite nice in this because it's kind of a nutty flavor. But use whatever kind of rice or risotto that you've got. About 4 cups of vegetable stock. I'm going to make this vegetarian. It's actually more delicious, in my opinion, with chicken stock. But it does make it non-vegetarian. You've got to think about your people. But chicken stock is actually more delicious because it's got that little edge of the sweetness to it from the chicken. Yeah. But you can use vegetable stock if you want to make it vegetarian. And we're going to have about 3/4 cup of Parmesan cheese because we're going to put 1/2 cup in it, and then we're going to put 1/4 cup on top. Yeah. And yummy. And that's it. That's all the ingredients. So we're going to take our oil. We're going to heat it in a nice big frying pan. We're going to cook the onion and the squash so that it's all soft and hot and delicious and like that. And we're going to use frozen squash. It's softer than the real thing. And so you can decide if you need to cook it a little bit longer or not. This does not have big chunks of squash in it, so it kind of melts all together, at least when I do it. So we're going to add the rice, and we're going to cook it for another minute, all in the oil and the squash and the onion and like that. They're all cooked through now. What did that take? Maybe, did you use fresh squash? Fresh squash, about 15 minutes. Not fresh squash, less, about 5 minutes. And so we're going to add the rice for about a minute, just to get everything kind of coated is what it really is. And then we're going to stir in 1/2 the stock. Not all of it, 1/2 of it. We're going to bring it to the boil. We're going to reduce the heat. We're going to simmer it for about 8 minutes or something until basically all the stock has been absorbed into our rice. Correct, because we're making rice. Correct? And we're just not making it with water. We're making it with the stock and with the onions and the oil and the squash and everything. But it's all boiling and simmering and getting yummy and getting incorporated. So you look at it. I like to stir it, not constantly, but occasionally while it's simmering and absorbing, because then everything gets melded properly. And also you don't get anything stuck to the bottom of the pan. So you've now got the rice, the stock has been absorbed into the rice, right? You've got rice, you've got cooked rice. Now we're going to continue to add the stock, a little bit of time, and we're going to keep stirring it over the low heat, and we're going to add it and it absorbs, and add it and it absorbs, because now the rice is getting tender. Add it and absorbs. If it's too much stock, don't put it in. You know, it depends on how it looks. If it's too little, put in a little more. You see, it's to make it thick and yummy, and the rice is delicious, and it needs to look, well, it needs to look like risotto, right? And not like soup. So we've got it all. It's nice. The rice is soft. Everything is blended properly. You've put in as much liquid as you need to do. Let's take it off the heat and add the Parmesan. Add the 1/2 cup of Parmesan and stir it all in. Yum, 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 yum. It gives it that lovely cheese to it, the grated Parmesan. Yeah, yum, yum. If you don't have Parmesan, yes, you can use some sort of a different cheese because people are asking about that. Use something that's white, for heaven's sakes, because, you know, you eat with your eyes. It needs to be something that will melt properly. People are asking about mozzarella. I don't see why not. But Parmesan is a little bit better because it's a little bit denser of a cheese. But whatever you've got, as long as it's white. Not Swiss, as long as it's white and kind of sweet in its way. Okay, so we've combined the cheese. And if you're coming with this to a potluck, take the cheese with you, and when you rewarm it, you add the cheese, because the cheese goes in at the last minute. And then you're going to heat it up a little bit more, maybe if it's gotten cold, and then you're going to sprinkle it with some more Parmesan, and there you have it. Delicious, easy to do, not very expensive. Everybody likes it. If you're bringing it for a potluck, make it all together, but add the cheese when you get there, because when you reheat it, you want to add the cheese. Otherwise, the consistency goes. It's nicer to have the cheese done at the time when it's hot. Mm-hmm. And there you have it. It's delicious. It is easy. And, well, all right, if you're lazy like me, it's not very time-consuming because I used frozen. There we go. And now we're going to have our adventure recipe. Now, what makes an adventure recipe an adventure recipe? Well, all the things that make it not a safe recipe, really, right? It is something that some people might have an allergic reaction to, but you've taken a survey, and if people have put down fish or shellfish, you are not serving this. I don't care if most people can eat it. If somebody can't, don't put it on the table, because utensils cross-contaminate, just naturally speaking. And it is, well, it's fish. And fish and shellfish oftentimes have a dietary, an allergy, or religious prohibition. So it's really an adventure recipe. But if you're sure it does indeed meet one of my requirements, you can indeed see what's in it right up front. I like people to be able to know what it is they're looking at in addition to the labeling. Yeah. So it's labeled. It is brought forward only if it's appropriate with the group. And it is delicious. It's a fish stew. And, yeah, people say I don't do, yeah, it's a good point. I don't usually do fish recipes just because I think that there's so many allergies to it. And if you have a prohibition against it, you really shouldn't have it out. And also, you know, the scent of a fish stew is delicious, but it is a wee bit overpowering, depending on what else is being served. Yeah, so that's just my opinion. Okay. And, yes, it's a very good point. Yes, it's expensive to make, too. Yeah, that's a real fair point. Where I am in the States, and I know that this is a global show, and a lot of you live places where seafood is very readily available and rather inexpensive. But where I am, it's kind of expensive. So, because it's just, well, I guess it is local, but it's still kind of expensive. Okay. So here's it's a real basic fish stew, and it's delicious. And you've got to be, it's the adventure recipe. So we're going to have 2 pounds of a fish fillet that we're going to cut into chunks, something firm and white, like haddock or something like that, or bass, or something that you have availability to. And I guess people say you can use salmon. Yeah, I guess you could use salmon too, but something firm. 2 pounds of shellfish, like mussels and clams and shrimp. If you're going to do shrimp, please take off the shell and devein the things. And don't just have people have to make a mess with their fingers, which will make a mess on the floor, just naturally speaking. And then you'll need lots of napkins and stuff. Please remember that this is company food, so to speak, and you need to make it neat and easy to eat. So if you're going to use shrimp, you need to take the peel and the vein out, to peel the thing so you can just eat it. I don't know. People are asking, what's the difference between shrimp and prawns? I have no idea. I think they're the same. Look the same. Oh, somebody's saying, it's kind of, oh, hello. And people are saying that prawns are big shrimp. Good. Yes, I don't usually use the little squiggly ones. I don't even know what they're called. But they're not for this, I don't think. Well, I guess you could, but they won't look nice. That's why it's expensive. A tablespoon of oil. 2 tablespoons of butter, because it gives a nice edge to it. A nice big onion that we're going to finely chop. 2 carrots, also finely chopped. 4 celery sticks. Let's give them extra celery. All finely chopped. All the little vegetables are going to be chopped up. We're going to get a couple tablespoons of flour just for dredging. 3 cups of fish stock. You don't have fish stock available to you, which is not available everywhere. Use vegetable. Do not use chicken. It's weird because it doesn't blend well with this. Use vegetable stock. You can also have, we've got 3 cups of stock, and we've got about 1.5 cups of white wine, a dry white wine. If you don't want to use wine, but you think it's okay to use fish and shellfish, you can use apple juice. It's very nice in it, or you can use water, or you can use more vegetable stock, good point, or fish stock. About 1 pound of little potatoes that we're going to cut in half. We're, of course, going to clean them if we need to. 2/3 cup of heavy cream. Do not use milk. Use cream, because otherwise it won't stick and it will look funny. And some chopped parsley, just because we're going to sprinkle it on top because it's pretty. Okay, so now I'm very big on washing everything, right? So you know this. You wash the fish fillets and you pat them dry. And if you're using frozen, you defrost them. Yes, I think frozen is fine. If you're using frozen, you need to defrost everything. And I like to rinse it off anyhow and to pat it dry because you don't want the excess water in there. The seafood, of course, you throw out anything that's broken and you take all, you scrub them and you pull off the stuff that hangs out. People think it's called a beard. Really? Well, you pull off the excess stuff and you shell the shrimp so that you don't have shells. Okay, so now we're all ready. Everything's chopped, everything's cleaned. And we're going to heat the oil and the butter in a big pan. We're going to add the onion and the carrot and the celery. And we're going to soften them. And we're going to cook them until they're all nice and yummy and cooked through and hot and beginning to soften. We're not going to make squish out of them, of course. And now we're going to add the flour just to make it nice and thick with the butter and everything. And we're going to cook it for another minute. Now, I actually then take the pan off the heat because of the sizzle, but you can decide. You take the pan off and you stir in the stock and the wine. You stir in the liquid, whatever kind of liquid you've decided to use. Not the cream. Stir in the other liquid, yeah. You stick it back on the heat and you keep stirring this because you've got a lot of liquid and you've got the butter and the oil and the vegetables and like that, until the mixture comes to a boil and thickens. It'll take a little while, maybe 5 minutes. So you kind of stir it because you want to have the flour and want the whole thing to thicken. And that's really the purpose of the flour too, right? To make the whole thing kind of thicken. So it makes a lovely, it's to a boil, it's really, really hot. Now we're going to add the potatoes. We're going to simmer that whole thing until the potatoes get soft. It's about 15 minutes. Cover it, reduce the heat. We bring it to a boil, cover, reduce the heat, simmer it with the potatoes inside for about 15 minutes. If you've got new potatoes that are kind of biggish, I said cut them in half. Cut them in smaller pieces. You can use cubes of potatoes if you need to, but make it small enough so that when you in 10-15 minutes of time of simmering, they're done, and you don't have to cook this for hours. You know, not hours, but you know what I mean. To make them small pieces. Now we're going to add the fish. Of course, the potatoes are cooked through, but they haven't fallen apart, right? We're going to add all the fish and the shellfish, and we're going to stir it all around so that it is incorporated, all nice. And now we're going to put in the cream because now's the time. We're going to bring the whole thing back to a simmer. We're going to cover it. And we're going to cook it for what? About 10 minutes, maybe less. People are saying less than 10 minutes. Okay. Between 5 and 10 minutes until the seafood is cooked through is the answer. And you know, of course, to discard any unopened shells also, because that means that it's gone bad inside. So you want to cook it through so that the fish is cooked through. Yummy. You're done. You have a wonderful, hot, delicious fish stew. And yes, I think that it is served with either pasta, which is very nice. You know, those of you who have been here, and then you sprinkle it with parsley when you put it in the dish and go to serve it, because the parsley looks nice on it. Yes, I think that you should have pasta or rice to the side, and then people can take as much as they want. And yes, George, I know George always votes for mashed potatoes, and it's certainly a good idea, but it's to the side, yes. And you know, I see that our time together is nearly up. So that's our adventure recipe. Delicious, easy to do, and everybody can see that it has fish and shellfish, although you are going to label it. So, and our time together is up, is nearly gone. I hope you learned something. I always learn something from these shows. I hope you did too, because we talked about education. Thank you very much for coming. Thank you for listening. Thank you for returning. Thank you for all of your participation. If you would like to contact us, we're recipeforpeacenow@gmail.com. The website is recipeforpeacenow.com. The last 5 shows are archived on the website. All of the shows are archived at blogtalkradio.com/recipeforpeacenow. Thank you very much for coming. Thank you for listening. And please do come again. Thanks. Bye-bye.